This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude the program with the second part of his presentation, given the following day, that builds upon the groundwork of deep politics that he's just explained, to focus on the role of Dick Cheney on 9/11/2001.
You know, I've been in public speaking for 60 years, and what I'm about to say this afternoon may be about the most important topic, the most serious topic, and the most alarming topic that I have ever talked about in those whole 60 years. I want to talk in the same vein as Webster Tarpley on Friday about the grave threat to world peace that we face in the possibility of a U.S. attack, possibly a nuclear attack on Iran, and how important understanding the truth about 9/11 is as perhaps our best available means of forestalling that terrible possibility. Now, I'm the third person, I think, to remind you of what Brzezinski warned Congress about last February, that an attack on Iran would lead to a spreading and deepening quagmire, and that it would very probably be preceded by, and these are his words, a terrorist act in the United States blamed on Iran. It almost sounds as if we should invite him to our conference. He doesn't say an incident by Iran. He said an incident blamed on Iran, and that, of course, is what frightens all of us here so much. Now, there's been talk about this possible attack on Iran for at least 2 or 3 years now, and Seymour Hersh, in particular, has been predicting it regularly every 2 or 3 months. And that might make you think that, well, if he keeps predicting it, well, then it isn't really so serious after all. A number of people predicted it for March of this year. Then it was predicted for April the 16th. And then it was predicted for May the 17th. Does that mean we shouldn't be alarmed then because we just keep getting these warnings? Well, I had lunch with Dan Ellsberg about 10 days ago, and I was at the time fairly optimistic and said so. And then on Saturday, June the 16th, there was a newspaper story in the New York Times which revealed that the New York Times is worried about this. Now, that's a sedate newspaper, and they don't raise their voice extremely, but they said that there is a behind-the-scenes debate in the administration over between the Cheney position, those in Vice President Dick Cheney's office, who are pressing for greater consideration of military strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities, and the faction of Condoleezza Rice, who for a year now has been trying to get the United States to join forces with Europe, Russia, and China to press Iran to suspend its uranium enrichment activities. Now, here are a couple of things that weren't in the New York Times story. Remember, we've had many stories about this from many different sources, and it's surprising the extent to which there is consensus about them. The plans are there, and they've alarmed a lot of people inside the Bush administration who are leaking in various directions. And one of the things that has been leaked is that these attacks, if they occur, will be massive, that there are more than 450 targets, many of them underground. And the second thing that has been leaked by many people is because they are underground that there's a serious risk that the attacks will be nuclear. I mean, I feel I'm dealing with insanity when I tell you these things, but there it is in the newspapers, and we have to deal with it. This is CNN. Among the options U.S. military officials have been asked to examine is the use of nuclear weapons against underground facilities for Iran's controversial nuclear program. Now, I want to agree strongly. I'm going to disagree a bit with Webster Tarpley later on, but I want to agree very strongly with him that this isn't just a threat that we will get into a long time struggle with an Islamist fundamentalism, which we have helped foment by our excesses, although that certainly would be one of the consequences. It also very much risks confrontation with the Soviet Union, who do not want a nuclear war going on their borders, and a confrontation with China. It's a good way to unite the world against the United States in a way that it is not yet united against the United States. I read a book once about geostrategy, and it was in the middle of the 1990s, and it said, the geostrategic nightmare for America would be a course of action which united Iran, China, and Russia. Well, that's exactly the formula that this threat is leading towards. Now, the Times story about Rice and Cheney said nothing about Robert Gates, who's Rumsfeld's successor as the Secretary of Defense. But Gates has a reputation for wanting to realign defense policy with the non-military strategies advocated by Rice. And, in fact, he has been replacing a lot of Rumsfeld's people inside the Pentagon, and I'm particularly happy that he got rid of Stephen Cambone, who was the head of the defense intelligence activities that were second-guessing the CIA estimates and saying, yes, we do have weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and leading us, therefore, into an unnecessary and disastrous war in Iraq. Now, I'll read one sentence from a recent story that Gates has been leading, has played a largely quiet role in steering U.S. policy in a more realist direction, promoted as well by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. That difference has made a growing number of hawks increasingly unhappy, including many neoconservatives who had grown disillusioned with Rumsfeld's refusal to increase the U.S. forces in Iraq. You hear that Rumsfeld was let go not because he was too much of a hawk, but because he wasn't enough of a hawk. He opposed the surge. So Rumsfeld's replacement by Gates can be taken as a sign that the Bush administration is perhaps less likely than before to attack Iran. The in-house forces that led inexorably to war against Iraq have been weakened by the departure of people like Rumsfeld and Cambone. But paradoxically, the weakening of the in-house hawk contingent increases the chance that an attack on Iran will be preceded by a second 9/11, the most likely scenario for an attack that some people obviously very much want anyway. And here I'm going to quote from an article from a former CIA officer. It came out in 2005, but many people have repeated its gist since then. He has noted that the plans to attack Iran were drawn up, a quote, to be employed in response to another 9/11-type terrorist attack on the United States. And he went on and he said, just like Hirsch, that the plan includes a large-scale air assault on Iran employing both conventional and tactical nuclear weapons. And here's a sentence that's so important, I'm going to read it twice. As in the case of Iraq, the response is not conditional on Iran actually being involved in the act of terrorism directed against the United States. Let's listen to that again. As in the case of Iraq, the response is not conditional on Iran actually being involved in the act of terrorism directed against the United States. This is what Brzezinski was saying when he said that it could be preceded by a terrorist act in the United States blamed on Iran. This is, I think, a real threat, and it makes what we are doing here extremely important. Well, what can we do about this? Our ally is the truth, and truth, in the end, is powerful. But the power of truth is long-term power. It's not short-term power. You can't say, oh, I've discovered something and run out in the street and expect the world to turn around and give you a Nobel Prize. History doesn't happen that way. We have to acknowledge that the powers of sanity, reason, and information are traditionally weak in trying to constrain forces in power that are intent on war. But they are not powerless. Daniel Ellsberg has argued persuasively that the strength of the anti-war movement was the necessary deterrent in stopping Richard Nixon from using nuclear weapons against North Vietnam in 1971. And with the internet, as you just heard, the 9/11 movement has communications and research resources not available 4 decades ago. The task today before the 9/11 movement is to persuade the American people not to allow a military response to a second 9/11 attack until that attack has been subjected to a far more critical analysis than the first 9/11 ever underwent. And particularly, we have to push those to people in power and people in the Democratic Party. This will require some redirection of energy. Like all research movements, and I've been in a few of them, the 9/11 truth movement is becoming ingrown, debating more and more within itself over issues which alienate the general public. This is the Stephen Jones spoke very graphically of certain issues like the Twin Towers becoming a mud wrestling pit where people in the movement go after each other. More importantly, I think that the 9/11 truth movement has tended to focus on detail at the expense of analytic depth. That the 9/11 truth movement has tended to focus on false simplicities at the expense of analytic depth. The initial simplicity was the government's. 19 Arabs did it all. Or maybe Al-Qaeda did it, and Al-Qaeda did it alone. But this false simplicity has produced an opposite, a mirror opposite false simplicity. And here I'm quoting, I'm afraid, from a book by a man whom I respect very much, but I don't respect this sentence. The Bush administration and its agencies did it. So you have these two alternatives. The Arabs did it. No, not the Arabs. The government did it. I submit that this is a false dilemma. To say that the Arabs did it or the Bush administration did it is a false dilemma because there are other possibilities. Another false dilemma is the endless debate as to whether the Bush administration, quote, let it happen on purpose, Lee Hop, or made it happen on purpose. The first point I want to make is that the 9/11 truth movement is a movement that wants the truth. It is not yet a movement that exactly has the truth. And my second point, that the Lee Hop is another false dilemma, is because there is clearly another alternative. I have to say that I find it very hard to believe that the Bush administration as such either let or made it happen. And most of the Americans I know, and this includes most of the people I know who disbelieve the official position, tend to agree with me on this. It's obvious that there were people within the government who were involved, but I think we should clearly avoid blaming an entire administration for the acts of a relatively small cabal. In my forthcoming book, The Road to 9/11, I suggest that there's a quite different possibility, that much of the organization of 9/11 came from outside the government altogether, from what I call a meta group, well represented inside the government, but based outside it. I talk about, some of you know the story of P-TECH, this extraordinary high-tech industry with capital invested in it by people later identified by the Bush administration as being Saudi Arab terrorists. There is a whole milieu of Saudi capital very closely allied with Texan capital that has historically involved the Bush family and the Bin Laden family, and in organizations like the Carlyle Group has involved both of them simultaneously. This group, I think, my candidate for Meta Group was located within what is often called that Texas-Saudi business milieu, but for reasons that are clear in my book, I call the Texas-Saudi Geneva milieu, because there were other international financial interests besides Saudis and Americans in this milieu. I'll just quote a sentence. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International was one such meta group, and Berezovsky representatives participated in another, which allegedly met in Saudi billionaire arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi's villa in France in 1999, and has been accused of plotting the Russian 9/11 of Moscow bombings in that year. Somewhere within the shadowy Texas-Saudi Geneva milieu, there's surely room for a meta group as well. We should at least contemplate the possibility that there was a global meta group working as an unrecognized force X operating in the world that had the various resources and far-reaching connections necessary for the successful 9/11 plot. Now, I was heartened recently to see that Russian General Leonid Ivashov, who's closely allied with Webster Tarpley in the Axis of Peace, has a similar hypothesis, that he points to a mixture of, and these are in his words, oligarchs out of government and politicians in government. And what I'm now reading is from Ivashov. The organizers of those attacks were the political and business circles interested in destabilizing the world order and who had the means necessary to finance the operation. The September 11th operation modified the course of events in the world in the direction chosen by transnational mafias, that's what I mean by a meta group, and international oligarchs, that is, those who hope to control the planet's natural resources, the world information network, and the financial flows. This operation also favored the U.S. economic and political elite that also seeks world dominance. Well, I don't often agree with Russian generals, but in this particular case, I do. Perhaps because of my 4 years' experience as a low-level Canadian diplomat, I find it hard to believe that the Bush administration and its agencies could have been responsible for 9/11. But it's clear that some individuals in the administration should be held to account for what they did on that day. And I have made it clear at all the recent conferences that I have attended that the first person to be so held accountable is Dick Cheney. But my issue is that Cheney should, for the first time, be required to testify about 9/11 under oath. Hopefully, of course, we can have this happen before the U.S. bombs Iran. And as I see it, it's no accident that Dick Cheney, the most likely suspect in the first 9/11 for Iraq, is now also identified as the most likely candidate to instigate a second 9/11 for Iran. In my book that's coming in September, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, there are actually only 2 out of 15 chapters that deal with 9/11. Most of it is what's happened in the last 50 years that got us into this nightmare. But my book is being published by the University of California Press, And I believe it will be the first University Press volume that calls for the questioning under oath of Vice President Cheney. It wasn't easy, by the way. I submitted the manuscript in March 2006. It took fact checkers. It took months with a lawyer. But the press signed on and is publishing a book with that thesis. And here we have to address, my book is written in very cautious academic language because I don't just want to appeal to crowds on the street, I want to appeal to the people who could change the position of the Democratic Party. And here we have to deal with the problem of psychological resistance to be overcome among those who are most likely to reach Congress. And I'm repeating something I said in Arizona. The more status someone has in this society, the harder it is for them to listen to suggestions that there is something illegitimate about the power structure in which they have that status. Thus, the paradox that ordinary people are more likely to disbelieve the official theories about 9/11 or JFK than are people with higher education and greater access to information. So my book, of which, as I say, only two chapters deals with Cheney, the chapters in 9/11 are 100% about what Cheney did on the morning of 9/11 between 9:12 and 10:39 a.m. And my book is addressed to the problem of the ignorance of the highly educated. The 9/11 report is an example of concerted cover-up, partially by omissions, and just as importantly by its cherry-picking of evidence and contrived misrepresentations of fact. And it is itself evidence of what is being covered up, because there is a pattern to their misrepresentations. Now, if you go out on the street corner, it's all very well to call the report a pack of lies. But in fact, the 9/11 report is carefully written, almost all of it by lawyers, carefully footnoted, and it really only lies in certain places. And there is a consistent pattern to the misrepresentations, and the pattern that I'm talking about is the consistent downplaying, trivialization of the role played by Cheney on that day. So that's why I look in such detail at what happened in an hour and 29 minutes that morning. There's a question which I'm... Does anyone here not know the issue of what time Cheney arrived in the presidential bunker that morning? Everybody knows about it, right? There are two different versions. Norman Mineta, and I'll be saying more about him, was the Secretary of Transportation. He arrived there around 9:20 a.m. I think he maybe arrived a little later than he said he did, but not much later, and said that when he got there, Cheney was already there. And then in the 9/11 report, the commission heard this testimony from Mineta, and they simply suppressed it. They said nothing about it, and they gave their own version of when Cheney arrived, which was 50 minutes later. Simply omitting Mineta's testimony, they claimed that Cheney, and this now is a quote from the report, arrived in the room shortly before 10, perhaps at 9:58. Now, David Ray Griffin calls this claim an obvious lie, but I think it's not a lie in the sense of a deliberate, baseless falsehood. I believe that Cheney did enter that room at that time, as logs are said to indicate. But there is what lawyers call material misrepresentation in the word arrived, because Cheney had first arrived a half hour or so earlier, and then left the room to go back into the tunnel between the White House and the PEOC, the bunker, to have an important phone call with the president before returning at 9:58. The important claim that Cheney had first arrived well before 9:58 does not rely on Mineta's testimony alone. It is based, in part, on earlier testimony from Richard Cheney himself. because he told Tim Russert of Meet the Press on September 16th, 2001, when his memory was fresh, only 5 days after the events, in an interview that's still available on the White House website, that he arrived at the bunker before the Pentagon was hit. In other words, before 9:37 a.m., not 9:58, but before 9:37. The 9/11 report suppresses this and follows a second account in Newsweek, also based on an interview with Cheney himself, which now had him leave the office at 9:35, 2 minutes before the Pentagon was hit, and arrive in the bunker, quote, shortly before 10 a.m. We shall see in a moment that new evidence, which only surfaced in the last year, corroborates Cheney's first story and makes his revised timetable extremely unlikely. The first obvious point is Cheney gave two different accounts. One, he arrived before 9:37, the second one around 9:58. One of these accounts must be wrong. Should we trust this man if he comes before us and says we need to launch another war because of a second 9/11? I think we need to know more about what he did in the first one. What is at stake in this issue when he arrived is not trivial. Important orders were issued in this hour from the bunker. One alleged order, whose content is uncertain, which Mineta claims to have heard around 9:25, a second order to ground all planes at 9:45, and a third order, which instituted something called continuity of government, which I am going to talk about, probably before 9:54. By Mineta's account, corroborated by Richard Clark's book, Cheney had arrived in the bunker in time to give all three of the orders. By Cheney's second account, he arrived after all three had been given. The report flagrantly and systematically failed to deal with Mineta's and Clark's testimony. Okay, what's this new evidence I'm talking about? Last year, there was a movie released to reinforce the 9/11 report called Flight 93. And in connection with that, they had an article in Vanity Fair which for the first time released tapes from NEADS, the NORAD Northeast Air Defense Sector, which showed that there was a report of a third aircraft approaching Washington at 9:21. It's so important, I'm going to read it, partly because it's an absolutely crucial event. It should have been in the 9/11 report, and the 9/11 report suppressed it. 9/11, Master Sergeant Dooley, another hijack. It's headed towards Washington. Major Nasapani, give me a location. And then a third voice, not identified. Okay, third aircraft hijacked, heading toward Washington. Now, this urgent message at 9:21 is a key to everything that happened in the next 20 minutes, but it's not repeated in the 9/11 report. It should have been. It corroborates Mineta's story of a plane approaching at 9:25. How many people don't know Mineta's story? It's also been referred to here, of hearing Cheney giving an order with respect to an incoming plane at about 9:25. Now we've had, on the NEADS tape, that there wasn't a report of an incoming plane at 9:24. We didn't have that before. It corroborates Cheney's original account of his movements, that he arrived in the PEOC before 9:37, and it discredits the estimate that an approaching plane at 9:34 or 9:35 prompted the Secret Service to order the evacuation of the Vice President from his White House at just before 9:36. The point is that the Secret Service knew everything that the FAA knew. Richard Clark says that in their book. So if they saw a plane coming in at 9:21, the Secret Service would have come in at 9:21. It's inconceivable that the Secret Service, as the report wants us to believe, waited for 14 minutes and then rushed into the Vice President's office, seized him, lifted him off the ground, and hustled him out from his office to the bunker. They did that in response to the first report of a plane approaching Washington, and we now know clearly that was at 9:21. Now, the claims to the claim of 9:35 in the 9/11 report appear to have been constructed with great care, but there's been cherry-picking of the evidence. The footnotes cite a Secret Service timeline memo for the vice president's entry into the bunker at 9:58 and also into the tunnel between the entrance tunnel at 9:36. And I think these times are accurate. If we imagine that Cheney entered the tunnel at 9:36, but from the bunker end, not the White House end, and then returned to the bunker from the tunnel at 9:58. But what about the estimated departure from the vice president's office just before 9:36? Well, if the other dates, other times can be corroborated by the Secret Service timeline, you would expect that the departure from his office could be easily verified also. But here the timeline is significantly not cited. And if we ever get that timeline, and I hope we will, I predict that we will find the time on the timeline is not 9:36 at all. It's much more likely to be 9:21. Now, Mineta's story. How many people have never heard of Mineta's story about the incoming plane? I will just read to you from Mineta's testimony to the commission. The commission said, cannot possibly say, oh, we didn't know about that. Mineta testified to them, and unlike Cheney, he testified under oath. This is a quotation. During the time that the airplane was coming into the Pentagon, well, that's obviously Flight 77, there was a young man who had come in and said to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, do the orders still stand? And the vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? Commissioner Romer, questioning Mineta, established that this would have been around 9:25 or 9:26. However, the 9/11 commission said a primary radar target tracking at a high rate of speed heading toward Dulles Airport was incoming, was only discovered at 9:32 a.m. Well, why did they say that when we know that there was a report of an incoming plane which they suppressed at 9:21? What about that one? Unquestionably, the 9:21 report of a third hijack was a crucial event. It led immediately to the launching by needs of planes from Langley, Virginia. And here's the order from the same tape in the same minute. Okay, American Airlines is still airborne. He's heading towards Washington. Okay, I think we need to scramble planes from Langley now, and I'm going to take those fighters from Otis and chase this guy down if I can find him. But because of this misidentification, American Airlines 11, the report said that this was response to a phantom aircraft, an aircraft that did not exist. At first glance, the Neige report of a third aircraft at 9:21 appears to be the plane that Mineta referred to. It also fits neatly with NORAD General Arnold's initial testimony to the commission that NORAD learned of Flight 77's hijacking at 9:24 a.m. But the 9/11 report rejected Arnold's testimony as incorrect. In fact, they hinted that he might have committed perjury. What they meant by this was that the plane reported was not identified as Flight 11. Instead, these were, quote, reports about a plane that no longer existed, American 11. Thus, the report claimed that Neige air defenders had no advance warning on the third plane. And in their book, the chairman, Keene and Hamilton, relied on the same quibble about the identification of the plane and are even more misleading. If anyone comes close to a lie, it's these two chairmen in this sentence. In their words, NORAD claimed that the Langley jets were scrambled in pursuit of American 77, yet that was impossible. At 9:24, NORAD had not yet been notified that American 77 had been hijacked. Well, it wasn't impossible. On the contrary, it was pretty clearly the case, even if the controllers were not yet aware of the identity of the plane to which they were responding. Now, this handling of the plane alarm illustrates the distinction between an outright lie and a deliberately constructed deception. And there's a great deal of that sort of stuff in the report. Anyway, Mineta told his story more than once in more than one location and under oath, and he pointed to corroborating testimony from the deputy FAA chief, Monty Belger. They had both of them as witnesses, and as far as we know, they never asked any questions about this flagrant contradiction between Mineta's testimony and Cheney's. And what they did do instead, we had a story that was very embarrassing. It's extremely embarrassing because these orders that Cheney referred to, of course the orders still stand, there were no official orders that we know of at 9:21. The president had to give those orders, and he didn't give them until much later, after 9:45. Mineta, telling his story, stated unambiguously that the story referred to, quote, the plane coming into the Pentagon. And in 2002, when there had been a certain amount of noise about this discrepancy, the White House floated an alternative to the Mineta story, implying that Mineta got the time wrong and the plane wrong, and I call the second version the Cheney version because it relied on testimony from Cheney himself. So CNN suggested in September 2002 that a dialogue like that reported by Mineta did occur, but with respect to Flight 93, sometime after the Pentagon was hit at 9:37. Now, the 9/11 report did not deal with the second version, the Cheney version, either. In fact, it tacitly implied that the story was false by suggesting that there were no orders or response to Flight 93 until after Flight 93 had crashed. So instead, finally, we get a third version. This one comes from not very far away, not Cheney this time, but Mrs. Cheney, and by the designated White House perjurer, I. Lewis Libby. They relied on the notes of Lynn Cheney and Lewis Libby, and they gave a third version. This is the one that's in the 9/11 report. They didn't trust Norman Mineta. They trusted I. Lewis Libby. Doesn't that tell you that there's something a little fishy, as Stephen Jones would like to say, about the 9/11 report? The third version of the incoming plane story unambiguously postponing the dialogue until after Flight 93 was hit at 10:03. I can quote from the report, but take my word for it. They take the same dialogue and make it happen 1 hour later. Now, no one has suggested that all three nearly identical versions of the incoming plane story happened in the space of less than an hour. Two are falsifications, and of the three versions, the Mineta version, the Cheney version, and the Mrs. Cheney-Libby version, I would have to say, on the basis of the track record, the one which would carry the most credibility would be Norman Mineta. And here we have a situation. Somebody's account is wrong, and in this case, somebody's account is not just wrong, but there's probably been falsification of evidence. And so for this reason, I think that the notes of Lynn Cheney and I. Lewis Libby should be subjected to various serious scrutiny. Mr. Libby should come back to the courtroom yet again and or to some kind of venue and testify. And here is where interrogation under oath could either lead to charges of perjury or to a very different story as to what really happened. I want to talk about continuity of government. Continuity of government was instituted by the third of these important orders before 9:54 a.m., Continuity of government, or COG, was a long-established plan radically revised in the Reagan era by guess who? Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. For a response to an emergency, which among other things, and this is a quote from back in the 80s, set aside constitutional and statutory requirements and established its own process for creating a new American president. I can hardly believe I'm reading this stuff that's going on, but it happened. There are two very good books about this planning in the 80s. The extraordinary thing is it was set up by a secret order by Reagan, and the people who were doing the planning were more or less outside the established bureaucratic hierarchy of what I call the public state that has to account for what it does. It was instead a deep state, one meeting in secret, not accountable to anybody except maybe Reagan, and about which we know very little. They had Vice President George H.W. Bush was in on the planning, and most of the executive work was being done by a name we've thankfully not had to deal with much recently, Oliver North. And in Mann's book, the program called for setting aside the legal rules for presidential succession in favor of a secret procedure for putting in place a new president and his staff. Alfonso Chardy wrote the definitive story about this back in 1987, and here's what he said. The planning called for, quote, suspension of the Constitution, turning control of government over to FEMA, emergency appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and declaration of martial law during a national crisis. Well, it's absolutely Orwellian to call this continuity of government when, in fact, it's obviously plans for very, very radical change of government. So I say in every talk, COG, they call it continuity of government, but it's a trick out of 1984. What a perfectly titled book for, because 1984 is when we got first wind of this plan. It was not continuity of government. It was change of government. Now, in reporting all this, James Mann in his book noted correctly that the original purpose was to keep the government running during and after a nuclear war. But the Reagan administration changed that by executive order 12636, to cover, quote, any national security emergency, including natural disaster, military attack, technological emergency, or other emergency. So by this opening up, this is how Dick Cheney was able to institute continuity of government, as we call it, COG, radical change of government, before 9/54, on September the 11th, 2001, set up a second parallel bureaucracy that for at least for some weeks, if not months, was meeting in hollowed out government shelters in mountains, a second bureaucracy, or what the Washington Post called a shadow government. This is Orwellian. But it gets worse. It gets worse. What was even more Orwellian was that in the 1980s, when Cheney and Rumsfeld were planning for suspension of the Constitution, Cheney was just a congressman from Wyoming, while Rumsfeld, who at the time was CEO of a drug company, was not officially in the government at all. And in the 1990s, and this is since, I've learned this since my talk in Phoenix about this, it became even more bizarre. In April 1994, Tim Weiner announced in the New York Times that in the post-Soviet Clinton era, the Doomsday Project, as it was known, was to be closed. The nuclear tensions of that era having subsided, the project has less than 6 months to live. On October 1, it's history, a Pentagon official said. Well, this article persuaded the authors of the two books, the only two books to give us an extended discussion of continuity of government. They both wrote in the 1990s, that Reagan's COG plans had now been abandoned under Clinton because, quote, there was, it seemed, no longer any enemy in the world capable of decapitating America's leadership. In fact, however, only one phase of COG planning had been terminated, a Pentagon program for response to a nuclear attack. Instead, according to the new biography of Rumsfeld, has just come out by Andrew Coburn, a new target was found. This is under Clinton. Although the exercises continued, still budgeted at over $200 million a year in the Clinton era, the vanished Soviets were now replaced by, can you guess, terrorists. There were other changes, too. Before, in the earlier times, the specialists selected to run the shadow government had been drawn from across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans alike. But now, down in the bunkers, Rumsfeld found him in politically congenial company, the players' roster being filled almost exclusively with Republican hawks. It was one way for these people to stay in touch. They'd meet, do the exercise, but also sit around and castigate the Clinton administration in the most extreme way. A former Pentagon official with direct knowledge told Coburn, you could say that this is the Pentagon official, a secret government in waiting, close quote. More quote from the official. The Clinton administration was extraordinarily inattentive and had almost no idea what was going on. Now, this is a little overstated because Richard Clark in his book makes it clear that there were many groups continuing to plan COG, and Clark himself was the author of Presidential Decision Directive 67 in 1997, which was only just abolished about a month ago by President Bush, who has got a new directive which takes the whole of COG and essentially takes it out of all these things, FEMA, Homeland Security. It's now all in the White House. You can run a government without attention to the rest of the bureaucracy. In a case of COG, you run it from the White House. This is all hard to believe, but it is what is happening. It's in print. So in the 1990s, a Democrat, was president, but had no idea that inside his administration there was a secret government in waiting composed of Republicans. This included Rumsfeld, who was still CEO of a drug company, and Cheney, who by now was CEO of Halliburton. These two people are from the outside world, the oligarchs that Ivashov talked about, planning for ways in which to interfere with the orderly constitutional succession of government. Neither of these, Rumsfeld or Cheney, had any official position in the government. Both were planning for COG, suspension of the Constitution, under a secret order from the Reagan administration that Clinton didn't know existed. This secret government in waiting exemplifies what in my book I call the deep state, that part of the state which is not publicly accountable and pursues its goals by illicit means that will not be approved by any public examination. What we have seen since the first 9/11 is the stealthy and devious takeover of the public state, including the rule of law, by the deep state. And in my book, I have a whole chapter showing the close analogies between what North was planning for in 1984, wonderful year, 1984, and what has been instituted with COG by the Patriot Act, which obviously had been written before 9/11, and by all these various different things like the suspension of FISA, the suspension of habeas corpus. This is what North wanted 17 years earlier. Now, in my talk yesterday, I argued that the deep state is an ongoing phenomenon in American life, not just an accidental excrudescence under Reagan. that it's an ongoing phenomenon in American life that it has encroached before on the public state, most notably in the case of the Kennedy assassination. I suggested also that when the deep state makes such encroachments, it does so by means of illicit proxies. The law has to be broken. The suits in the offices aren't going to do it. They turn to their ongoing allies in organized crime. And in every episode I talked about yesterday, when there were four of them, the people involved in drug trafficking. Thus, time after time after time, they have been involved with people involved in drug trafficking. Now, if this is true of the earlier ones, and there is an analogy with what happened in 9/11, then, in the case of 9/11, those drug proxies of the deep state were almost certainly people embedded in Al-Qaeda. So I conclude that if the deep state has been active for years, it is not just going to roll over and quit just because Rumsfeld has left the government. My hypothesis is that there is still a deep state, there is still an Al-Qaeda involved in drug trafficking, and together they are still capable of producing a second 9/11 as a pretext both to attack Iran and, just as importantly, to protect the illicit power of the deep state. Because if we ever had real public processes in accounting for these people, there are names that I've mentioned in this talk who would probably go to jail. We're talking about the largest homicide in the history of America, and we're talking about a homicide which has not yet been properly investigated. That is a challenge to the Democratic majority in the present Congress, and it is an even more important challenge because if we don't resolve what happened with the first 9/11, we are being told by people even like Brzezinski that we face the possibility of a second one. To this day, we do not really know the consequences of having instituted COG on 9/11. We do know that Cheney himself frequently disappeared from public view after the attack. At these times, he was working from a COG base, Site R, the so-called underground Pentagon on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border. And there, according to the Washington Post, he became, in effect, the leader of what the Post called a U.S. shadow government. If, yes, he needs to testify under oath, and these are some of the things he needs to testify about. First of all, something I didn't have time to describe, the June 1st JCS order, which for the first time ordered highest level approvals for intercepts of off-course planes, which explains why there were no interceptions on that day, because they had to be approved. Ever since since June the 1st, which is only two and a bit months before the event, they had to be approved by Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld wasn't available. He was out in the grounds surrounding the Pentagon, according to his own account, helping load people onto stretchers. The nation was under attack, and the SecDef was out of contact with his staff. And there's a whole section where I describe how in exactly the same time Cheney was outside of in the tunnel away from his staff. I believe that they absented themselves from their staff so that they could talk about something which their staff was not cleared to listen to, which was COG, which was the highest level security item. And that's why we don't have the orders. Both Keene and Hamilton complained that the most important order that day, the shoot-down order, there was no trace of it. And I argue in my book it was no trace of it because it was being used by a different channel that the ordinary, not the channel, the phone channels in the bunker, not the phone channels in the military headquarters in Pentagon, the defense emergency room. It was being discussed privately by Cheney and Rumsfeld. Well, two people cannot plot an overthrow of the government. If those two people were talking to each other about COG and the way in which their own staffs couldn't hear it, we can be certain that there were other people involved who did know about the COG, and that's the sort of thing we need to know about. Okay, these are the things they should testify under oath about. The June 1 JCS order, ordering highest level approvals for intercepts of off-course planes and raising the threshold for getting SecDef approval of each intercept. Two, the contested time of Cheney's arrival in the presidential bunker, which is absolutely crucial to the decision-making of that morning. Three, Cheney's orders with respect to a plane approaching Washington. And did this occur around 9:26 a.m., as testified to by Mineta, or 10:15 a.m., as per the 9/11 report? And four, and above all, Cheney's call or calls with Rumsfeld and the president before or around 10 a.m., and did they discuss so-called continuity of government? All right, to sum up, various top-level people have warned us about the risk of another 9/11 as a pretext for massive and possibly nuclear bombing of Iran. Cheney has been identified as the prime advocate for a military strike against Iran. It is clear that Cheney created self-contradictory stories about his role in the first 9/11 episode, and we should call him to account for the first episode as the best way, perhaps the only way, to forestall a second one. My last paragraph is addressed to you in this room. If what I have said today is about 9/11 and peace has any importance, then what each of you does in the months to come will be very important too. Thank you very much.
You were listening to Peter Dale Scott, a former Canadian diplomat and English professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of many books on the relationship between political assassinations, the deep state, and criminal syndicates. His most recent book, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, is now available. Scott made the point of the necessity to put Cheney under oath. Three members of the House Judiciary Committee are calling for hearings in the committee as to the impeachment of Dick Cheney. One of them, Representative Robert Wexler of Florida, is asking people who support the call for hearings on Cheney to sign a petition at his website, WexlerWantsHearings.com. That's WexlerWantsHearings. Wexler is W-E-X-L-E-R, WantsHearings.com. Thanks to Drew Noftel and the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society for making their conference material available. They've put the entire conference on DVD and have those available through their site at v911truth.org. v911truth.org. Thank you for listening. Like you're riding to hell.